May it please the court, one slight correction. I thought she said Michael. It's Manuel Cantu. There are three issues presented in this case. It's a case in which Mr. Cantu had been previously convicted. No, excuse me, he had not been convicted. I stand corrected. He had been placed on deferred adjudication probation for the offense of deadly conduct, involved firing of a firearm into a house without due care that there might be occupants. He had a six-year deferred adjudication probation. There was a motion to proceed to adjudication, and it alleged several things, but the trial court found that he violated two conditions. One, by associating with persons of disreputable character, Mr. Christopher Garza in particular, and two, by remaining in a vehicle where a firearm was present, which was a condition of his probation because of the underlying offense. At the hearing to proceed to adjudication, the state offered evidence that, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. The two bases that I mentioned were the bases for the revocation. The others were either withdrawn by the state or were found not true by the court. With respect to the allegation that he associated with persons of bad character, there was an evidence that Mr. Garza, Christopher Garza, who was in the bed of the truck, was a member of a gang, and that the appellant was also in the gang database as a member of a gang. All of the evidence about the membership of these two individuals in a gang came from the testimony of a records custodian who maintained the Fort Worth Police Department's gang database.
What about Daniel's argument that you're not entitled to the constitutional protections of confrontation and cross-examination in a motion to proceed to adjudication?
Well, there are two answers, I believe, to that. The first one is, I believe that this is distinguishable from a motion to revoke. Scarpelli, the case that is primarily cited for that proposition, does say that the procedure to proceed to to revoke a probation is administrative in nature. However, in Scarpelli, which was decided in 73, the Supreme Court was interpreting Wisconsin law and says in their decision that in that case, Mr. Scarpelli had been found guilty, sentenced to a term in the penitentiary. The sentence had been suspended and he had been placed on probation. I would submit in that event that there is logic to saying that the criminal proceeding is concluded in light of the fact that the court has made a judgment as to guilt and the court has made a determination as to the appropriate punishment. And all that is suspended is the essentially ministerial act of sending the person to the penitentiary, the imposition of sentence. In our law, under the deferred adjudication statute, the criminal proceeding is not completed, it is interrupted. We have a situation where the defendant pled guilty, the court made a finding that the evidence was sufficient to support a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty of the underlying offense, but then suspended further action, deferred making an adjudication of guilt, and placed him on probation. When the court determined that there was sufficient basis to proceed to adjudication, the trial resumed. The court performed a PSI. The only real difference between a full trial is that in this instance, the right to have a jury decide punishment is waived as a function of getting deferred adjudication. The court had a pre-sentence investigation report prepared and later had a sentencing proceeding in which the court made a determination of what the punishment should be and sentenced the defendant, the appellant, to a term of 6 years in the penitentiary. This, I think, makes the situation distinguishable.
Procedurally, what is the difference?
I mean, procedurally,
there's no difference. It's just a break for the defendant. You're giving him a chance to live it out and not have a final conviction on his record. And once the court makes that finding that the evidence is sufficient to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, then you're not going back in this second proceeding and revisiting that issue. That finding's already been made.
You know, with respect, Your Honor, there's a great difference procedurally. As I said before, the trial process is interrupted. The cases are legion that after the determination to proceed to adjudication, the trial continues with a punishment hearing just as if the trial had not been interrupted for the purpose of deferred adjudication.
What do you do different?
What you do differently is you resume the trial. In the instance of a regular probation, the trial has concluded. The court has made a judgment which has become final at that point. The court cannot revisit the judgment of guilt. The court cannot revisit the judgment of what the appropriate punishment is. Once that person's on probation, the court is limited in punishment to a punishment of the maximum that it decided or less. It cannot...
Continuing them on probation or extending
yes, ma'am.
Probation?
Yes, ma'am.
Or it's not just a you're going to prison. I mean, procedurally, truly, procedurally, what do you do different?
I don't know a better way to answer it than I already have, Your Honor. I think procedurally they're very different. Because you're at a different part of the process when you stop and place a person on community supervision. And that's the distinction that I see. Further,
let me ask you this.
Sure.
In a regular trial, when you go to the judge for punishment, you have been found guilty, and then it's time for, I mean, often they go ahead and bifurcate the trial. Or, since it's a trial, I mean, if the jury decides guilt, or if it's a bench trial, then it's not bifurcated, it's a single proceeding. When you are in trial without a deferred in the middle of it, and the judge is determining punishment, do you have the right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against you in a regular trial when the judge determines punishment?
I have not briefed that, Your Honor, but I believe you probably do, because I think that's a part of the criminal trial either way. I'm not aware of any case that suggests that in that regular trial, that is not a part of the trial and part of the criminal proceeding.
All right. So if they've pled enhancements, whether it's a high bitch, a low bitch, or whatever, and do they have to put on a sponsoring witness to cross-examine for the records that they want to offer of the previous convictions? Because those don't come in during the guilt phase. And
I suppose they might if the defendant chose to testify. But I see your point. There are... I'm not aware of anything that has addressed that. It's an interesting question. Because you may...
If you have the right, you either have the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses at punishment or you don't. And it doesn't matter when the punishment comes, whether it's during a bench trial or after a jury finds you guilty but the judge is determining punishment, or after a judge has decided that they're going to adjudicate your guilt and hear the punishment. So it seems to me the rule would be the same. What's the rule?
Well, to begin with, this was not at punishment. The complaint that's raised here is during the determination of whether to proceed to adjudication. That's prior to a judgment of guilty, so it's not at the punishment phase. The punishment phase follows the judgment of guilty. And that's the best distinction I can think to draw there. A couple of other distinctions to make here. First off, when Scarpelli was decided, there was no deferred adjudication, at least in this state, and I presume there probably wasn't a process like that in most other states. Because classically, the process the Supreme Court describes in Scarpelli is the same procedure that we normally follow in a regular probation. In looking at the cases from the courts, the sister courts, Beaumont, Houston the 14th, and San Antonio, they cite a number of cases in which they have also found that there is not a right to a Sixth Amendment confrontation right. And they cite a number of federal cases for this proposition. What's interesting is that all of those federal cases are being decided under federal law. There's a federal rule of criminal procedure that has a somewhat different standard than the standard announced in Scarpelli. Scarpelli, when it goes through these different rights that it says are extended to a person who is on probation and is having the probation revoked, it does say there is a right to confrontation. Quote, the right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses unless the hearing officer specifically finds good cause for not allowing confrontation. Now, that's a direct quote in Scarpelli from the underlying decision the year before in Morrissey, which related to parole hearings. There was no specific finding of good cause to not allow confrontation in this case. The objection was simply overruled, and no such finding was made. Now, in the federal cases that are cited, particularly in Trevino, there's a federal rule, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32.1B2C, and I'll supply a letter brief, if I may, after submission with these citations for the court's convenience. That rule has a slightly different standard. With respect to confrontation, it says that a defendant is entitled to an opportunity to question any adverse witnesses unless the court determines that the interest of justice does not require the witness to appear. Similar, but not the same wording, and not necessarily the same concept. One is a good cause concept, and the other is the interest of justice, which I submit is basically a broader concept. There is one federal case, a decision out of the district court in the D.C. Circuit, Ash versus Kelly, where the court argues that the confrontation clause, or the confrontation right under the Sixth Amendment, flows to the defendant, and that's the language they use, flows to the defendant under the 14th Amendment as a due process right. So there is clearly a due process right under the 14th Amendment. And I suppose in anticipation it comes up to the third thing, is an objection, confrontation, Sixth Amendment, First Article 1, Section 10 of the Texas Constitution, sufficient to preserve the issue of confrontation as a due process right under the 14th Amendment. And I haven't briefed that, and I honestly don't know the answer as I stand here today. Clearly, though, it does inform the court of what the complaint that the defendant had was, and that is that he's not being allowed to confront these witnesses who made the determination that he was a gang member. And being a gang member is the only basis for saying that he was associating with somebody of bad character. Mr. Garza's being a gang member and his being a gang member. The appellant's alleged membership in a gang is presumably, by inference, what makes him aware of the membership in a gang by Mr. Garza.
Well, that's where I want to go. While all these questions, I think, are very challenging legally and interesting legally, there's a simpler question in my mind, and that is, and I'm going to ask the state attorney the same question, where is there any evidence that this defendant knew that Mr. Garza was a gang member? Because that's what you've got to find that allegation to be true. And I've actually read the record, and I can't find any reference to him knowing there were allegedly members of different gangs. So, I just don't see any evidence there.
Thank you, Justice. That moves me right along to my second issue, and I completely agree with you. I don't think the analogy I made in the brief is that I live next door to several people that I know fairly well. I visit with them, and actually we have a neighborhood where we talk a lot. I can't tell you what the religion is of the person that lives next door to me. I don't know if they're Baptist, Church of Christ, Methodist, or Roman Catholic. By the same token, I don't think we can impute knowledge of one person's membership in a gang to another person merely because that person is a member of a different gang. And that seems to be what is imputed here, and I would agree there isn't sufficient evidence to make that conclusion. And the case law is that the state does have the burden of showing that there is knowledge that this is a person of disreputable character. Finally, there's a third issue, and that is, did he have sufficient knowledge of the presence of the gun in the truck?
Is there any evidence whether the shot was fired from the gun from the truck or whether...
No, Your Honor.
Any evidence in the record when they got into the truck? Was before or after while the gun was being shot?
No, Your Honor. The record is silent on that. And I might point out there were two witnesses who were not charged the state could have presumably called, Ms. Rodriguez and Mr. Duran, who were listed as witnesses in the police report, who did not appear, were not subpoenaed, were not brought to trial, and we didn't hear from them. And they could have answered that question. The only evidence about this truck, there was a call that the officers got that shots had been fired. They go to this bar. They park half a block away, according to the testimony, approach on foot with their weapons drawn. A woman runs out, points at the truck that is proceeding southbound on North Main and says, that's it. That's the truck. That's all she says. They don't know who she is. They don't know what she's making reference to, whether it's the call that came in. They go back to their car. They chase the truck down. It only goes a block, so it apparently wasn't speeding. The truck's in the back with Mr. Garza, and the pistol's in the back of the truck with Mr. Garza, and Mr. Cantu is driving the truck. My time is up. I'll reserve the rest for later.
May it please the court. Justice Gabriel, the state did not have to prove that Mr. Cantu knew that Mr. Garza was a gang member. The state had to prove that appellant Cantu was associating with persons of disreputable character. So the fact that both of these young men self-identified to the police as gang members in a document that was not generated for the purpose of criminal prosecution, the gang classification records are useful for primarily not putting Crips in the same cell with Bloods or some other variant to keep the jail population safe. The records are also kept for purposes of federal FBI databases, not on individuals, but on general trends and tracks. From that standpoint, they are clearly police documents kept just in the course of police business and not meant, like the testing of cocaine would be, to generate evidence to be used at a trial.
And They were evidence used at a trial.
They were, but they were not generated for that purpose, and that's what makes them documentary evidence and outside the scope of Crawford as well.
So, Danielle, you're saying if I'm on probation and we're going to be dealing with people disreputable harmful character, and I go to my doctor's office and he has hired a receptionist who's on parole, and I let her sign me in, I have violated the conditions of my probation?
No. There would be an abuse of discretion in revoking your probation in that case. Your association there is not, it's an incidental to another business transaction. The association here with other people in the truck was, and I seem to recall the record indicates that the woman who ran out of the bar clearly indicated to the police that that's the truck the shots came from.
She said, that's the truck.
That's all she said? Then I stand corrected.
So maybe it's the truck that tried to run her down. Maybe it's the truck
that sidewalk. That certainly would also be a criminal act for which the police should perhaps chase the truck. It's not, but it was not a reasonable inference. It was not an unreasonable inference for Judge Westfall to draw that a call came in that shots were fired. A woman was gesturing that that's the truck, and the police then sought out that truck and lo and behold did find a gun in the back. There were no ballistics done. The gun was never tested to the best of my knowledge.
So there's no evidence that shots were fired from that gun?
Not in this record, no.
Is there evidence?
Not in this record, no.
He cited cases in your brief that for the proposition that the defendant, the appellant, did not have to know that Mr. Garza was of disreputable or harmful character?
No. Since we're dealing with what is essentially administrative proceeding, there's no mens rea to violation of the probation. There would just be the general criminal requirement that he committed a voluntary act or a volitional act in violating his probation. And the state would argue that driving the truck away from a scene of a shooting is a volitional act in associating with people of disreputable character.
by in a truck. I would hope they would pick me up and get me out of there before I shot at him. So we don't even know which way the shots were going.
We don't. And I'm certainly not here to argue that this was the ideal revocation proceeding. I think that the Scarpelli issue that appellant raised that's not quite in his brief, there's a couple of different answers to why that really Scarpelli should remain the law with deferred adjudication proceedings. First of all, on a deferred, you, as the defendant, say you're guilty. You signed a document, a judicial confession, admitting to all the elements of the offense, and that is admitted as a court document on that date. The fact that the judge does not accept your plea of guilty doesn't mean that you didn't already say it, plead it, that you were guilty. The only thing that's deferred is acceptance. So essentially, when you're having a deferred adjudication proceeding, you are there to determine punishment. And this is especially true since the amendment to the deferred adjudication statutes, which give defendants who have deferreds much greater rights on appeal than they once did. I mean, there was a time not that long ago where there was no right to appeal.
But now they can appeal the decision to proceed to adjudication.
Yes.
So
there's also the issue that I think it's glossed by in a lot of the probation revocation cases, which is getting a deferred is a contractual agreement with the state, and the state is giving you something by offering to let the whole thing disappear if you can live out your clean deferred. But in exchange, you are waiving some rights, too. And if you look at the laundry list of rights you waive, you do waive some substantial constitutional rights. So even though you may have them at the beginning, as part of accepting this contractual deal with the state, you do waive some of them.
How can you challenge the decision to adjudicate if there is no standard to which the state has to adhere or a court has to adhere in
The state still has to meet the standard of the greater weight of credible evidence, including any reasonable inferences which may be drawn. In other words, the trial court's decision has to be so wrong as to clearly lie outside the zone of reasonable disagreement. Now, I think that's really what this case comes down to, was whether Judge Westfall's decision to revoke the adjudication, does that fall outside the zone of reasonable disagreement? And I think the questions about hearsay and Crawford are, I think as someone noted, they're interesting legal questions, but they really don't get to the meat and potatoes of this case. If there are no further questions, the state will...
And I will say that I will be brief, but as Judge Duffino knows all too well, that's a promise honored more often in the breach than the observance.
You're John Hardy.
Oh, that hurt. Just a couple of points. First off, there is a requirement of effectively mens rea, a requirement that a person whose probation is being revoked must know that the other person is of disreputable character. It's a rule set forth by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Page 7 of my brief cites the two principal cases, Shortnessy versus State, a 1972 case, and Jackson versus State, a 1971 case underlying it. Jackson is a three-judge panel opinion back when the Court of Criminal Appeals still had panels. I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I think Shortnessy is the court sitting en banc. In that instance, the allegation was based on the association of the person whose revocation was being challenged with another person who had a criminal record without any showing by the state that that person, that the first person, the probationer, knew that the other individual had a criminal record. This is very analogous to that situation. Justice Gabriel, as you pointed out, we've got a situation where there are two people who are in gangs, but there's no evidence that this self-identification as being in a gang happened when the two were in the presence of one another. And further, they're in two different gangs. And certainly membership in the Barrio Centro doesn't mean you know what the North Side, Trace North Side, or Trace whatever North Side, I can't remember right now, who their members are. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence to show that Mr. Cantu knew the pistol was in the truck, on voir dire, the police officer that made the stop was asked, was there a pass-through window, a camper window, in the back of this single bench seat or single cab truck, and he said he didn't remember. So there's no evidence that there was a way to communicate through that window. This is a truck going down the street, so the only way to communicate with people in the bed is basically shout out the window. There's no evidence that there was any communication of that sort. And as you said, Justice Dauphineau, we don't know whether or not this is a situation where they were driving by and saw people they knew that asked for a ride and they jumped in the back of the truck. We don't know necessarily that this is the truck, this is the truck, relates to the report of shots fired. There's just a wealth of information that we didn't have in this case, and there's just not a presumption that because you're in a gang and somebody else is in a gang, you know of those affiliations. And there's just simply no evidence on that point at all. Shortness, yes, submit, controls. With respect to Scarpelli, and the argument that there is some contractual relation between the state and the defendant, the cases I'm aware of say that that probation and the conditions of probation are a contract with the court and the probationer. But Scarpelli makes clear that notwithstanding that, and in Scarpelli, as I argued before, you've got a completely finished trial. You've got, as a matter of fact, the case that Scarpelli overruled was one that said that probation was an act of grace, and thus you didn't have any rights. And Scarpelli came in and said, no, you do have some due process rights, even though they are reduced or contracted from the rights that you had prior to your conviction. So those rights are still there in the contractual nature of an agreement, whether it's between the court or between the state and the accused, is irrelevant to the continued existence of those rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your argument. It was very helpful. And the case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will